Thank you very much to all of you for reading quite a big passage. Chris has already prayed for us, so we'll get straight into it. How do you prove that somebody is the greatest of all time? Or as some people would say these days, how do you prove that somebody's the GOAT? And we're going to take the example of tennis, and I'm going to defend Novak Djokovic as the greatest of all time. And I'm not just going to do that by pointing out some good stuff he's done. I'm going to point out things that only he has achieved. Nobody else has done this. So Novak Djokovic is the only man in tennis history to be the reigning champion of all four majors at once across three different surfaces. He's the only man in tennis to achieve a triple career Grand Slam. He's currently holds the record for the most weeks at world number one. Any guesses, anyone? Throw a number out there. Well, that's roughly a third. He's been world number one at the moment, 395 weeks, and there's a big debate at the moment whether people reckon he's going to get to 400 or not, which would just be extending his record. He already holds it. He's got 96 singles titles across his entire career and a lot more records I didn't have space for. Seems pretty good, right? But I know some of you are thinking, hang on, Carlos Alcaraz is close on his heels at number two. And, believe it or not, Djokovic still loses. So you might point out, yeah, Wimbledon final, he lost. Italian Open quarterfinal, lost. Monte Carlo Masters, round of 16, lost. And that's just the games that he's lost this year. And you might also say, well, there's others like Nadal or Federer who hold records and achievements that Djokovic doesn't. Now, I would still try and say I think Djokovic is the greatest of all time. But it's not exactly an indisputable or definitive case, is it? There's some grey area, there's some other people who've done stuff he doesn't. It's not exactly an absolute claim. Now, God claims to always be the greatest with absolutely no comparison across all of eternity. But how has God proved that? How does God respond to his greatness being challenged or being attacked? Can that even happen? Is God just like Novak Djokovic? He has his day in the spotlight, but then eventually somebody else will overtake him. Or maybe he's only great in certain areas. He's only made certain achievements, but he isn't actually great at everything. Or maybe God's just consistently the best. Like, he's really good a lot of the time, but there's blips. He loses. He gets challenged by people, and he doesn't manage to hold up. Well, that's what this passage confronts us with this morning. It asks us, is God really the greatest, and how does God defend that greatness? Well, we left chapter 4 in a really sad place for the people of Israel. They're defeated and they're grieving. At the very start of chapter 4, back in verse 3, the Israelites lose an initial battle to the Philistines, and they ask, why did the Lord bring defeat? But sadly for Israel, that's just a rhetorical question. Israel seems to think that inquiring of God or consulting him is massively overrated. They instead think they can force his hand and take the ark into battle. Their logic seems to go, ark with us equals God with us. And they seem to be wrong. It ends in disaster for Israel. The ark's lost, Eli and his sons are dead, and Israel gets routed. Phinehas' wife sums it up at the end of chapter 4. As she was dying, the women attending her said, don't despair, you've given birth to a son. But she did not respond or pay any attention. She named the boy Ichabod, saying, the glory has departed from Israel because of the capture of the ark of God and the deaths of her father-in-law and her husband. She said, the glory has departed from Israel, for the ark of God has been captured. It's a sad note that we've just finished chapter 4 on. And that brings us to the start of chapter 5. We'll look at under three sections, which I think roughly follow the readings we had, and are also in your booklets. First point, chapter 5, God's supremacy and Philistine pride. The question of chapter 5 is this. Have the Philistines just beaten Israel, or have the Philistines beaten God as well? And it certainly seems like the Philistines reckon they've beaten God. Because what they do is they take the ark and they place it into the temple of their God. Implication, we're great, our God beat yours. But God says, no, only one of us is supreme. Have a look at verse 3. When the people of Ashdod rose early the next day, there was Dagon, fallen on his face on the ground before the ark of the Lord. They took Dagon and put him back in his place. But the following morning, when they rose, there was Dagon, fallen on his face on the ground before the ark of the Lord. His head and hands had been broken off and were lying on the threshold. Only his body remained. So the first time round, they come in, Dagon's fallen over, kind of like he's bowing to the ark. And I can imagine the Philistines would be kind of confused. Like, what's happened here? This seems weird. But they must just shrug it off as a coincidence, and so they put him up again. But the scene the next morning is even more shocking, and doesn't seem like much of a coincidence anymore. Because again Dagon's bowing, but this time he's lost his hands and feet, which are piled on the threshold. And the point's obvious, isn't it? Dagon is left completely powerless before God, no ability to act, no ability to think, no authority, and instead he's bowing to the God of Israel. And as is common with many of God's works, he proves his supremacy in a way that's going to be remembered. Notice Dagon's priests don't ever step on the threshold again after the Lord beats Dagon here. It's a memorable defeat for them. But God doesn't stop there, because he's intent on showing the Philistines that he is supreme, not them. And he wants to show them that they can't beat him, whether they have the help of Dagon, whether they don't have the help of Dagon. And so he shows his supremacy, and he does so in a very similar way to the plagues of Exodus. We see the first round in verse 6. The Lord's hand was heavy on the people of Ashdod and its vicinity. He brought devastation on them and afflicted them with tumors. When the people of Ashdod saw what was happening, they said, "The ark of the God of Israel must not stay here with us, because his hand is heavy on us and on Dagon our God." So they called together all the rulers of the Philistines and asked them, "What shall we do with the ark of the God of Israel?" They answered, "Have the ark of the God of Israel moved to Gath." So they moved the ark of the God of Israel. We see here that God's hand is heavy on the Philistine people and on the city of Gath. Not Gath, Ashdod. And they realize that this isn't going how they thought for them or for Dagon, their god. And they realize this ark's dangerous. It's not safe to have around. But they reckon they can control the situation. They gather a wise ruling council who comes up with this genius solution. You know what? Let's just kick the can down the road and see what happens. Well, verse 9. After they had moved it, the Lord's hand was against that city, throwing it into a great panic. He afflicted the people of the city, both young and old, with an outbreak of tumors. So they sent the Ark of God to Ekron. Round 2, much the same as the first. More tumors, more devastation. Notice there, it affects young and old. Nobody's escaping from this. This devastation's total. No wonder Garth's panicking and wants the Ark gone. But guess what? They stick with their genius solution. Let's just kick the can down the road again. Well, verse 10, as the Ark of God was entering Ekron, the people of Ekron cried out, "They have brought the Ark of the God of Israel around to us to kill us and our people." So they called together all the rulers of the Philistines and said, "Send the Ark of the God of Israel away. Let it go back to its own place, or it will kill us and our people." For death had filled the city with panic. God's hand was very heavy on it. Those who did not die were afflicted with tumors. And the outcry of the city went up to heaven. You see, the people of Ekron aren't fools. They can see where this is going, and they have a go at their foolish leaders. What are you doing? Why are you bringing this ark to us? And we see here in this third round of plagues on the Philistines that things are getting more and more severe. There's a mega panic in the city going all the way up to heaven. We see that God's hand is very heavy on it. And notice that it's not just tumors anymore. Tumors are what the lucky ones get now. We see that death has filled the city with panic. It's only those who did not die who get away with tumors. This is getting more and more severe. It's a terrifying picture, and it's one that makes a clear and simple point. God is completely supreme, and the Philistines absolutely are not. And the Philistines here should be scared. This is a terrifying picture of God's power. And for us, for God's people, God's supremacy is something that we ought to remember. It's easy at times for us to look at what we see around us and for it to look like God's losing, or he's not in control, or he's having to take second place. Like God's already been defeated and is having to meekly stand aside. Take, for example, the science and atheism versus God debate. In some ways, it can seem like God is pushed out, like there is no place for him, like he must just take a back seat to scientific discoveries, to rational and tangible modern evidence. He doesn't necessarily seem very supreme there. Or perhaps take the sad failings, evils, and abuses that have been perpetrated by the church over the centuries. It could be the Crusades. It could be the ever-mounting abuse scandals. It could be accusations against particular churches or leaders. Or it could be Christians saying foolish things on social media. Or it could simply be the Christian hypocrisy, which ends up hardening non-Christians towards Jesus. Gandhi said, "Christians are ugly, but their Jesus is beautiful." If God is supreme, then surely he would be able to keep his people in line and stop them going round disgracing themselves and him. Or take non-Christians who you've been praying for, talking to about Jesus for a while, maybe months or even years. But no matter what, they keep rejecting Jesus. They have no interest. Or maybe they are really interested, but they can't quite see who he is. They can't quite see his gospel clearly. The penny just never drops. We know that God desires people to turn to Jesus rather than perish. And we know that God's completely supreme in power. So can the supreme God not just open their eyes and overcome their barriers? Well, 1 Samuel 5 says to us, not so fast. Looks can be very deceiving. In this chapter, God looks like he's been defeated and captured by the Philistines, and he looks like he's out of control in enemy territory and outnumbered. If you'd run with that from ball one, and then you see what we've got to here, you'd have been completely wrong. Because God is always completely supreme, even if everything screams the absolute opposite. God is supreme over every government, every person, every situation, every atom of his creation. God is supreme over every scientist's discovery, over the choices of each person, and even over the failings of his own people. God's never out of control of anything. He's never outmatched in power, and nothing can nor ever will compete with God, which is a wonderful comfort for us. Well, that brings us up to the start of chapter 6. Our second point, God's glory and Philistine humility. We pick up again, 6 verse 1, after the ark has been with the Philistines 7 months. Just imagine that for a moment. The plagues we just see in chapter 5 going on for 7 months. The Philistines will be a mess. And finally, after this unbelievably long period of time, they tap out and they go to consult their priests and diviners. Verse 2, the Philistines called for the priests and the diviners and said, "What shall we do with the ark of the Lord? Tell us how we should send it back to its place." They answered, "If you return the ark of the God of Israel, do not send it back to him without a gift. By all means, send a guilt offering to him. Then you'll be healed, and you will know why his hand has not been lifted from you." They've realized that the ark needs to go, and the priests agree. They say, send it with a guilt offering. You'll be healed, and you'll know why this has happened. And they instruct them to make golden tumors and rats as a guilt offering, which parallels the gold and silver that Israel took out of Egypt. But there's a question here, which is, if they're making a guilt offering, what is it that they're actually guilty of? What have the Philistines done here? And the answer's tucked away for us in verse 5. In that little phrase where the priests command the Philistines to give glory to Israel's God. Remember the end of chapter 4? Glory had departed Israel. But that glory belongs to God. It doesn't belong to the Philistines. And yet they've tried to claim God's glory for their own. They have tried to rob God of his glory. They've made this terrible mistake, and now what they're left with is a hope that God might relent and have mercy on them. Notice verse 6. Why do you harden your hearts as the Egyptians and Pharaoh did when Israel's God dealt harshly with them? Did they not send the Israelites out so they could go on their way? These advisors of the Philistines, these priests, might be following a pagan false god, but they do know their history. And they absolutely school the Philistine leaders on the Exodus. They see a connection, one that we already spotted, between them and the Egyptians. They've seen these plagues keeping going. And they remember, Pharaoh hardened his heart, and that's what caused the Egyptians such bitter defeat. They see that Egypt did in the end send Israel on their way. And whether the priests definitely see this or not, there's been an ominous pattern developing here. Three rounds of plagues, each one getting more and more severe. And if you know Exodus history well, what comes after three rounds of plagues? A final, far worse plague that completely ruins Egypt. I think the priests do know their history pretty well, and I think they're probably seeing this and are urging the Philistines to humble themselves before they face even greater disaster. Now, the Philistines know they've already angered God, and they don't want to anger him more as they return the ark. So they come up with this careful plan to be extra sure. They don't want to offend God. So they take a new cart, pure, unused, undefiled in any way. And to pull it, they use two cows that have never been yoked and have just had calves. And notice what they do with the offerings, the golden offerings. They put the ark and the golden offerings separately onto the cart. They're not going to be the ones going inside any arks anytime soon. Now, somewhat strangely, I think, they still aren't totally sure after 7 months if God's doing this. I mean, a 7-month-long coincidence is quite something, right? So this plan of theirs also doubles as a test, and it's an impossible test. They want to know if this is God who's done this to them or not. And the cow, and so they, the way they set this up, the cows haven't been yoked before. They're not used to drawing a cart. This is not what they do. They're missing their calves, who they're naturally drawn to, so they want to go in the other direction, back home. On top of that, Beth Shemesh is uphill. It truly would be an act of God if the ark actually wound up in Beth Shemesh. There's no logical way this should work. And yet, amazingly, as the Philistines follow the ark, the cows take us straight to Beth Shemesh. They're lowing the whole way, which means that they don't like doing this. They want to be back with their calves. And yet, amazingly, no detours, no hesitating, no issues with being yoked and not being used to it. This is clearly a work of God. The Philistines see it get received by the Israelites, and they return home. And so, if we remember back to verse 3, what is it that the Philistines know now about why God's hand wasn't lifted? Why was that? Well, the answer is very similar again to the book of Exodus. God's made clear that he alone is God. God has shown the Philistines that Dagon, the plagues, and the impossible cart were all his works. He's shown them that he is God and they are not. The Philistines have humbled themselves enough to admit that. And they've stopped trying to claim God's glory. Notice, we don't know if the plagues actually get removed. We're not told. I think it's implied, but it's not really definite. which is the point here. The point is that God has been shown to be glorious and the Philistines have been humbled, not necessarily that the consequences are now gone. And this connection, which we noticed a little bit earlier back in verse 5, between guilt and glory is really crucial for us to see. Every single sin endangers God's glory. God's glory is the reality that his greatness and beauty surpasses everyone and everything in every way. You could say God's glory and supremacy are really closely intertwined. The very nature of sin, therefore, cuts right at the heart of God's glory. From the very first sin in the garden to sin today, sin claims supremacy over God rather than bowing before his glory. That's a massive insult to the infinite glory of God. And worse, it's something that we're all guilty of. Sin threatens God's glory by either treating him as really small and less great than he is, or by treating us as really big and far greater than we are. Do you see just how awful and serious this is? Does it fill you with dread? I know it fills me with dread. I mean, think about it. Every single sin that you or I commit is an affront to God. It's an attack on his glory, a put down on his majesty, a diminishing of his grandeur. This is not something that God will tolerate. God won't stand others taking his glory or diminishing it, whether they be Israelite or Philistine or Kiwi. God will act to declare his glory afresh, and he will act to humble those who would despise and steal it. God's glory is his, and it's his alone, and any attempt to diminish or claim or steal that glory is deadly. Well, that brings us to the rest of chapter 6, our third point, God's holiness and Israelite pride. Have a look at verse 13. Now the people of Beth Shemesh were harvesting their wheat in the valley, and when they looked up and saw the ark, they rejoiced at the sight. The ark came to the field of Joshua, Beth Shemesh, and there it stopped beside a large rock. The people chopped up the wood of the cart and sacrificed the cows as a burnt offering to the Lord. The Levites took down the ark of the Lord together with the chest containing the gold objects and placed them on the large rock. On that day, the people of Beth Shemesh offered burnt offerings and made sacrifices to the Lord. We see here the sheer excitement of these Israelites as they receive the ark of God back. They take the cart and the cows and they use the great rock in the field to make a sacrifice to God. They celebrate and they rejoice at seeing the ark back with God's people. And in verse 18, we see that the large rock in Joshua's field becomes yet another memorial to God's works. But then in verse 19, absolute tragedy. It doesn't seem that Israelites have learnt the lesson of their pride back in chapter 4. It seems like they're just as overfamiliar and cocky when it comes to God and the ark as they were back then. Not everybody's view of God seems to have changed. The Israelites don't seem to see him as holy or supreme or great or glorious. And so 70 men reckon they can just rock up to the ark and have a look inside. And tragedy follows. Looking into the ark's wrong because that's where God's glory and his presence dwells. By doing this, they're diminishing God's glory. They're essentially saying, he's not that big, not that important. I can just rock up to him and have a look. And Israel and these people here in Beth Shemesh, these Israelites, they rightly see this blow as coming from God, and they grieve. And what are they going to do about it? Well, verse 20, the people of Beth Shemesh asked, who can stand in the presence of the Lord, this holy God? Seems promising. Well, second half of verse 20, to whom will the ark go up from here? Wait, what? I think the author wants us to join him here in banging our heads against the wall. Everything we've just seen here screams out, repent, humble yourself before God and throw yourself on his mercy. Inquire how this can be made right. Actually ask God what to do. Make some guilt offerings. Make some sacrifices. We've just seen that there's Levites there, verse 15. What on earth are they doing? But instead, what do they do? Instead of all those seemingly logical options, Well, they take one out of the Philistine top drawer. Swing your leg back and boot the can as far as you can down the road. It's tragic and it's so frustrating for us as readers, isn't it? But this is also the natural response of humanity, such a supremely holy God. It doesn't seem safe to be near him, especially when we know that we can't stand before him. He's so supreme and holy and glorious that it seems like no one can or should ever dare to go near him. Maybe you're here today and you reckon that you can rock up to God just like the Israelites did. Maybe you think that you're pretty good and you'll be fine. It's a fairly common view people have these days. When I meet God, I've lived a good enough life, he'll be fine with me. If that's you, then please let this be a warning to you. Nobody's good enough to stand before this holy God on their own. It's not going to go well for you, so please don't try it. But this also raises a problem for us, because raises a problem for Israel and for us, because we are his people, and we need God with us to help us. We don't want the end of chapter 4, where God and his glory depart from us. And so it's vital that there is a way for God to be with his people. It's vital that there is a solution here. And there is one, praise God, and to see it, we must look to another time when the enemies of God seem to be winning. That time is as the Son of God hangs on a Roman cross, and both human and spiritual enemies seem to have won. You hear the mocking voices of the crowds and the Pharisees saying, he has no power to save himself. You see Pilate's unwillingness to bow before Jesus' supremacy. And you can imagine the awful glee of the devil as he thinks that he's beaten and killed God's Son. Then there's the awful darkness in the middle of the day, and Jesus dies, and he's buried. And for 3 days, nothing. But God has not been beaten. God isn't taken anywhere against his will. He goes where he wants to show who he is and to fulfill his purposes. Like the ark in 1 Samuel 5, it was God who left Israel, not the Philistines who captured and forced him to go. Like Jesus, he chose to go to the cross. Nobody forced him to go there in a way that he couldn't stop. And at the cross, what Jesus is doing is making the ultimate guilt offering for us. He's draining the cup filled with all our rebellion, our pride, our hard-heartedness, our casualness toward him, our faithlessness, our offenses against his glory. Everything that keeps us from standing in the presence of this holy God. By trusting in Jesus as our guilt offering, we're counted as righteous and our sinners dealt with permanently. The offerings made and our crimes against God's glory are paid for. The guilt offering that we need is made and God can be with us. Which means that the right response to this glorious, great, supreme God is a counterintuitive one. We go to him, not away from him. We throw ourselves onto his boundless mercy. This is something that I think we all quickly forget. We forget that our sin is dealt with and that we can actually approach God. We keep trying to beat our sin on our own. Or we assume that God must go somewhere else or we have to hold him at arm's length because I'm just too bad. But that's wrong thinking. Because we actually can glorify God even when we sin by returning his glory back to him and confessing that we are guilty. As we do this, as we admit our guilt to God, and as we keep holding on to his guilt offering, we give him back the glory that only he deserves. This week, as I've been writing this sermon, I've been challenged again and again by God. Why do you so often push me away when you sin? Why do you keep thinking that you can offer your own guilt offering that'll make you right with me? Why do you keep saying because of your sin, where will God go up from here? Why will you not come running to me and throw yourself on my mercy? I came and died, sacrificing myself so that you could be with me and I with you. Friends, please don't forget this. When you offend against God's glory, please don't despair or try to make your own better guilt offering to God, which will make you right with him. Please don't try to keep God at arm's length because of your sin. Instead, admit your guilt, give glory back to him, and hold on to Jesus, your precious guilt offering, and keep clinging more and more tightly to him. The issue in 1 Samuel 5 and 6 has been seeing God's glory and supremacy and responding rightly to him. The Philistines start off proud, but end up humbled by God's glorious hand. But they also end up going back away from God. They push him away and they don't end up repenting. The Israelites are fickle, and they quickly start treating God with the same pride that they had back in chapter 4. But while God is supreme and glorious and we are guilty, he has also made the perfect guilt offering for our sin, which means that we can stand in God's presence as we cling to Jesus, our great guilt offering. As we've thought this morning about the guilt that we have before God for endangering and stealing and threatening his glory, and thought about the great guilt offering we have in Jesus, and because we want to give glory back to God as supreme and great above everything else, what we're going to do now is we'll take a moment of silence. It's a chance for you to consider the ways that you've done that yourself last week. And then I'm going to pray a prayer of confession for us. So a moment of silence to reflect. Our Father in heaven, we have seen so clearly that you are the greatest of all time, supreme in power, completely in control, infinite in glory, and we tremble at our sin before you. The thought that we are guilty of endangering or diminishing your glory is terrifying to us. We hate that this is what we, your children, would do to you, our Father. Please have mercy on us. We don't deserve to approach you, and we know that, but we do now because of the guilt offering that you've given us. We approach you for forgiveness, clinging to and trusting in Jesus alone. And as we confess our sin to you now, we give you back all the glory that you deserve and declare that your name is above every name. And it's that name in which we pray to you. Amen.